here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taken to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Today is Friday, November 23rd. I'm Claire Eagle.
And I'm Chirag Mahajan. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia to our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening. It is 5:05 p.m. and time for another full hour of independent news. Our headlines will cover local news from our UBC campus and from Metro Vancouver, provincial and federal news from across Canada, as well as news from around the world. Also on today's show, we will be bringing you our weekly science segment, Simply Science, with Sarah Chow. This week is part one of Sarah's interview with Dr. Shaw and Dr. Tomlenovich about an HPV vaccine. We'll also be talking to Sarah Ladune from the Commerce Undergraduate Society about a recent budget misstep, and with Sam DeBruzen about the Back to Hankies campaign.
All this, plus your weekend weather forecast, brought to you by the UBC Storm Club on behalf of the news team. This is News 101, your source for independent news, and now for your UBC campus and local headlines.
So we're joined in studio right now with Sam DeBruzen from the Back to Hankies campaign. Sam is a third-year UBC student who's been doing something unique and a little bit different to try and do his part to help the environment. So welcome to the show.
Hi, Claire. How's it going?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
I'm good.
So tell us a bit, I guess, first of all, what is this campaign?
The Back to the Hankies campaign is basically a UBC student-led initiative to try and get handkerchiefs into the hands of UBC students and paper towels out of the garbage, I suppose, or not even in there in the first place.
Mm-hmm. So, and where did you get the idea to do this?
I suppose this all came about... I guess the idea was first put into my mind when I did a high school exchange to Japan. And in over 90% of all the bathrooms in Japan, you can't find even a hand dryer. And there's really no paper towels in the public bathrooms whatsoever. So it's the cultural sort of norm or practice to carry around your handkerchief with you. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for the first month or two, I had sort of instances where I had to dry my hands on my pants a lot because mm-hmm. I would, you know, forget my hanky. But eventually I just sort of got used to it. And then that just sort of made me more conscious when I came back to the Americas and was sort of faced with just the option to dry my hands on paper towel again.
Mm-hmm. And so walk us through like the mechanics of what you're actually doing. I mean, how are you convincing students to use these?
So that's, I suppose, where the strength in our campaign lies because we deal on a student-to-student basis. So while we do take a small donation for the handkerchiefs, more importantly, there's an exchange of discussion and ideas and mm-hmm. thoughts. So that's where our strength lies. You know, we can tell students, hey, did you know that the sub is going through 40 bags of trash a day just out of the bathrooms alone? Mm-hmm. And, you know, they'll say no. And like, that's pretty convincing. And then when we just talk to them, that's where our strength lies.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think, of course, a lot of students are probably won over at first by the idea of something free and then the idea... Like, I guess probably the discourse behind that and the ideas behind it and probably the idea of 40 bags of trash a day that hopefully keeps them coming back to it a bit more. So I know that you are giving these out for free to students. How did that get set up?
Well, we were taking them by donation for the Ancient Forest Alliance, and we had two different handkerchiefs, and this was made possible by funding from the Student Environment Center, which is a resource group here at UBC. So using that funding, we purchased organic cotton handkerchiefs from the island, Vancouver Island, and we made those available by donation. And then the other handkerchiefs that we were selling are by a UBC created business called Rise Upcycling, where they take old clothes and sort of make them into great new fashionable products. And they thought this was a great idea, so they got in on this, and now they're helping me a lot with the campaign. And they also have their own brand of handkerchief that has their logo, the Red Feather. And yeah, those handkerchiefs are actually available for sale still in Sprouts in the basement of the sub.
Wow, that's actually a really interesting idea. Like, that, I guess, I mean, probably a lot of people are asking, like, how do you know that me using this handkerchief is more sustainable? And I guess knowing that it is upcycling and using kind of local work and local materials like that, it definitely is helping out a lot.
That's right.
Sam, I have a quick question. Just tracking back to those 40 bags of paper towels, do you have any idea where they go? Do they get composted or?
Yeah, so last year I was speaking with Justin Ritchie, the sustainability coordinator for the AMS, and he was sort of on the same page with me, and they actually started composting a composting program that was run by volunteers where they were composting the paper towel. But because it was run by volunteers, it wasn't exactly sustainable. And we can't do it here at UBC because, you know, you have to have a certain ratio of, you know, organic material and paper. And the amount of paper that we go through would overwhelm the composting facilities here at UBC, which, you know, speaks again to the volume because, you know, we have pretty good facilities here at UBC.
Mm-hmm. Oh, for sure. So, obviously, I mean, what you're doing right now is very much, it's on campus, it's talking student to student, it's getting people active that way. But going back to what you said about in Japan, like, it's just kind of a cultural norm. And I mean, excuse me if, like, if I'm wrong, but I imagine, like, that's where you want to see this eventually, right?
That's right. So that's why we're trying to make it as accessible as possible and actually connect with people, because that way they'll have more of an emotional or personal connection with using the handkerchief. And then once we get more people using it on campus, then there's more of an awareness about it. And, you know, people will see someone using a handkerchief in the bathroom. They're touching less things in the bathroom. They're probably able to leave the bathroom before the other, like, someone else who is even in the bathroom before them. So, you know, they're saving time as well. And, you know, it's sort of that iPod effect, like, oh, what is that? You know, gotta get me some of that. So that's what we're going for. The other real benefit to having people, you know, start using these more and more is that, you know, it'll get into our subconscious and our conscious. And we'll also hopefully start to see deeper thinking and further thinking into disposable culture. Because, you know, nowadays we dispose of everything, right? Food and beverages containers. And that's made of plastic or, you know, trees. And we just put it, you know, in the garbage, which goes into our land, which we have, you know, beautiful amounts of land in Canada, but, you know, the way that we're doing it is just not doing it justice. So, you know, the more we think about disposable culture, the more we have, you know, we think about it and have questions, you know, why are we using disposable diapers on our babies? Like, would I like to have, like, plastic on my butt? Like, well, I don't think I would like that. So why would my baby, you know? And that's another real benefit, I think, that we can see.
So I guess what are the next steps for you in this campaign? Is it still just focusing on campus, student to student? Are you thinking about going more into Vancouver? Or are you moving away from Hankies into a different area?
Right. So by my calculations, we probably have about 250 handkerchiefs out right now on campus. Because of the large population that we have, that's not quite a sizable amount of the population just yet. So we're still focusing hard on this campaign. And because it is a campaign, we're not just restricting it to 1 week. We will be doing probably two more weeks next semester. We'll be doing the same thing, but we'll sort of just, you know, keep on improving it. We like to hear from our friends, from our people who are sort of skeptical. You know, how can we make this a better campaign? How can we improve this and be the as effective as possible.
Does your campaign enter the washroom at any point?
which is
the most important.
We try not to assault people. But we do...
But advertising, for example, in washrooms is pretty common.
Yes, we
here.
Did have some posters up in the bathrooms, and unfortunately some of them got taken down. We're currently looking at new ways of postering, and we're also considering, you know, if we're advocating less paper use, we should use less paper. So we're actually looking into using used paper towel and, like, seeing how we can use that as signage. Mm-hmm. Because that'll really use the message. And as well, if the janitors are accidentally taking it down, you know, it doesn't really matter because we can put it back up.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we're just looking to make this campaign as effective as possible. So we are always welcoming questions and comments on our Facebook page, Back to the Hankies campaign, or on our website, backtothehankies.com.
Awesome. Well, yeah, it was great to hear from you and learn a bit about your campaign, and best of luck.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, guys.
Yeah, no problem.
Check us out online.
So that was Sam DeBruzen from the Back to the Hankies campaign. As he said, you can check out their Facebook, Back to the Hankies campaign. So we're going to take a quick break, but please do stay with us for more local news. I'm Claire Eagle, and you're listening to CITR News 101.
Your hands lightning fast. Can you flip it, scratch it, and just get downright funky on the turntables? Well, if so, you got to come out and prove it, homeboy. On November 23rd, CITR presents Are You That DJ competition going down Friday night at the Pit Pub. $8 to get you in the door in the day, but only $5 if you get your pass in advance. It's time to set the record straight on who's got the ill skills on the wheels of steel. So ante up and save the date, November 23rd at the Pit Pub. For more info on how you can get involved, hit up Campus Coordinator via email at campuscoordinator@citr.ca. Brought to you by CITR.
Here we go again. Who is the number one DJ?
Welcome back to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca. I'm Claire Eagle, and we're broadcasting to you live from the Student Union Building here at UBC. So recently, the Commerce Undergraduate Society last night repassed their annual budget after discovering that due to an error with quorum, the budget had been technically unoperational since the summer. So we have the CUS fourth year rep, Sarah Ledoon, on the phone with us right now just to explain what happened. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Claire.
Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, so what happened exactly? I know there's been a lot of talk about the CUS mismanaging money or, like, money being cut. So how did that come about?
Well, I think there's a lot of misunderstanding right now about exactly what happened. A few days ago, it was brought to our attention that the day that we passed our budget, which was July 18th in the summer, we didn't have quorum at this meeting, and essentially what happened is we had too many people proxying for regular board members for it to be considered quorum. So in a sense, our budget wasn't approved of officially.
Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, obviously that's probably a pretty big thing, but what happened with the AMS then? Like, how did they find out about it and step in?
It's difficult to say. It was drawn to our attention that a student approached a member of the SAC program, and the student in particular had been going through minutes and just was attempting to see if the budget had been approved of properly, and he sort of noticed that perhaps our budget hadn't been approved under AMS bylaws, and he brought that to the attention of the SAC member. Mm-hmm. And so we were contacted by Tristan Miller, who is the VP Finance, I believe it is, of the AMS, and so it was a very easy and simple thing to fix. They just attended our board meeting, and we passed it under quorum and everything is completely okay now.
So moving forward then, obviously, this issue with quorum was probably something that no one had really realized was happening. Are there any steps that are going to be taken just to make sure that that kind of error isn't made again?
Definitely. We will be writing in a requirement into our own policy about who we need to have at our meetings when we do pass the budget. It being such a very large item, and I mean essentially what runs the COS, we need to make sure that we have enough of our actual members and not proxies instead. Mm-hmm. And this will be included immediately and it should be passed by the next board meeting. Mm-hmm.
And I guess on a slightly different topic, but one I guess has been generating equally as much discussion, I know there's been a lot of talk about how there was a certain student group whose funding was cut unnecessarily or who had some problems with funding because of this budgeting process. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yes. So the student group in particular is JDC West. JDC West is a business competition that is held yearly, and this year UBC is hosting it. So it's something that we're very proud of. And we fully want to support all the students that are involved in this. However, with that being said, their budget this year had a minor and yet substantial mistake to it. The Excel sheet wasn't set up properly to include a very large sum of money, which equated to about $30,000. And so we were under this amount. So this money wasn't missing necessarily. It just hadn't been included. So our VP Finance looked at our budget, looked at where we could make cuts to other budgets for committees, and we were able to reallocate the money to make up for this mistake. Mm-hmm. Then there was a second mistake, in which case the JDC West team overspent on their budget. And so this created an alternative issue, in which case we had to find alternative sources of funding to make up for this difference, because mm-hmm. it was unfair to our own students. We have 3,000 students in the U.S., so it was unfair to continue cutting from their own budget when it wasn't their fault.
Right, and of course, I mean, you don't want to put the needs of that minority, no matter how important they are, above those of the student body at large.
Precisely. Mm-hmm. There's only 50 people on JDC West, and that represents about 1.6% of our entire commerce undergraduate population, and it just, as much as we want to support them as much as we can, it kind of came to a point where we had to say, what can we do as an alternative to continue cutting budgets.
Mm-hmm. And with the cuts that have been made right now, do you feel like that's going to negatively impact students as it is, or do you think that most of those cuts have been made from places that maybe there was a little bit of extra money or that there was a separate pool put aside?
I honestly hope not, mm-hmm. because I'm looking out for the best interests of all 3,000 students.
Mm-hmm.
There were a few budgets that perhaps we had allocated perhaps a bit too much money too. It was an optimistic allocation. It was mm-hmm. more like we're looking into the future and expansion, and can these committees perhaps spend this money in mm-hmm. a positive way?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm really hoping that by the time our new year rolls around, that we have found that there weren't any issues, weren't any areas where we could have perhaps had more money if mm-hmm. we hadn't made this $30,000 mistake.
Yeah.
And I do honestly believe that our VP Finance has everything in order and that it should be okay.
Yeah. Well, it doesn't sound like there's, I guess, too much of a problem there on that end, which is fantastic. So,
no, there really isn't. We try to make our budget as smart as we can. We have mm-hmm. a large buffer zone for particular issues like this one. So mm-hmm. We do make sure that the measures are in effect that can mm-hmm. help buffer against these big problems that might arise.
Awesome. Well, thanks, Sarah, for bringing some clarity to that, and thank you for your time.
Well, thank you for having me, Claire.
All right, take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So once again, that was Sarah Ladune. She's the fourth year representative from the Commerce Undergraduate Society here at UBC. So we're going to take a quick break, but do stay with us for your local headlines.
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
And welcome back to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca. We just had interviews with Sam Dabrusson and Sarah Ledoon, and you can, of course, listen to those interviews once again on our website, citr.ca/news. It is now time for your UBC campus and local headlines.
The patch of forest between Acadia Park and University Boulevard may soon become home to mid-rise residential towers as the Musqueam Indian Band moves forward on developing the land. The Musqueam Band wants to build low and mid-rise residential towers and a small hotel, as well as some commercial storefronts. These plans will be discussed at a public consultation in early December. Musqueam Councillor Wade Grant said the proposed construction has been in the works since 2008, when the province handed over a tract of land known as Block F as part of a settlement. The primary goal for the land is to provide a source of economic development for the band. Grant said, quote, Musqueam, like many other First Nations, wants to become a little more self-sufficient and move away from being dependent on third-party governments, end quote. Rezoning will be required for Musqueam's plans to proceed. Currently, the area is zoned for low-rise development only. Trisha Kaplan of the University Endowment Lands, who oversees urban development in the area that includes Block F, said, quote, we anticipate significant community interest, and the University Endowment Lands will be working with the Musqueam, setting an expectation of a thorough and transparent process, end quote. The Block F development will be the biggest to date for the band, and is projected to provide more revenue than any of the other properties, according to Grant, and the band hopes to break ground by 2014. The residential towers are planned to be 10 to 12 stories high, with 1,000 to 12,000 units ranging from housing for families to smaller condos. There will also be 30,000 square feet of commercial space and a boutique hotel with 100 to 120 rooms. It is expected that the development will become the primary source of self-generated revenue for the Musqueam. The band currently leases an office building in Burnaby and the old Fraser Arms Hotel building in Vancouver, as well as allowing some construction of private homes on Musqueam Reserve lands.
Pride UBC says their annual Transgender Day of Remembrance event on Tuesday night was a success, despite a schism that caused another Vancouver activist group to pull out at the last minute. The Transgender Day of Remembrance is a yearly event to memorialize transgender people who have been killed because of hatred, prejudice, and transphobia. Many ceremonies observing the event include the reading out of names of transgender people who were killed, but this practice was a major point of contention in the split between Starlight and Pride UBC. For the first time, Pride UBC, along with the UBC Sexual Assault Support Center, was going to partner with the Vancouver Transgender Day of Remembrance Society to put on the yearly ceremony. But clashes over what would happen at the event led Society Director Tommy Starlight to sever the partnership just days before, and they put on a separate ceremony in the downtown Eastside's Carnegie Community Center instead. Starlight said, quote, I came on board with the intention that we would work together, and that went sideways in a big hurry, end quote. Bobby Joe Greenberg, co-chair of Pride UBC and the organizer of the UBC event, felt that reading out individual names at the event in the Subs AMS art gallery would have been disrespectful. Quote, we didn't think that we should, because there's a lot of power that comes from naming people, and in some sense, there's a little bit of appropriation. We didn't feel that was our place to take that on. That's not something Pride UBC ever does, and it's something the Vancouver Trans Day of Remembrance always does, end quote. However, Starlight argued that reading out individual names should be an important part of the event. She said, quote, to give the voiceless people a voice, it's very powerful when we do that, end quote. Another point of contention was whether academics would speak prominently at the event. UBC professor Mary Bryson gave a speech at the campus event, but Starlight objected to the idea of having guest speakers. She argued, quote, the history of the TDOR is that it's not a pulpit for people with political or social aspirations to take the stage with all their cultural privilege, end quote. Bobby Joe Greenberg said that Pride UBC made sure that anyone who spoke kept the event's focus in mind. Despite the friction between the different groups, Greenberg was very happy with the way things turned out for the UBC ceremony. Over 100 people attended the event, according to Greenberg.
Vancouver police say thieves have stolen more than 100 storm drain covers this year, leaving pedestrians at risk of walking blindly into a gaping hole. Catch basins covered with large metal grates are located near curbs and in alleyways to drain water from roadways. Most are 1 or 2 feet deep, but police say some are as deep as 6 feet. Bruce Todd with the City of Vancouver said, quote, "Missing covers pose a significant public safety risk. Pets, pedestrians, cyclists, and motorists can all seriously be harmed by an open catch basin. In the dark, people may not recognize that a catch basin is missing or the open hole may be covered with leaves and debris, making it harder to distinguish the hole from solid ground," end quote. The cast iron covers, which weigh about 140 pounds, cost the city $176, while police estimate that they would be worth about $14 on the scrap metal market. According to police reports, 92 covers were stolen in June, and another 19 have gone missing since September. The thefts happened throughout the city, but police say a higher number of thefts occurred on the city's west side. Anyone who spots an open catch basin is asked to alert the city by calling 311.
The discovery of a suicide pact involving dozens of young people has prompted community groups to call for changes to youth and family services in East Vancouver. 24 children, most between 12 and 15 years old, were taken to hospital as a preventative measure, after the suicide pact was discovered in late September. Almost all of the children are Aboriginal and live in the Grandview Woodlands area. While authorities managed to step in and prevent a tragedy, a report by the Network of Inner City Community Services says several over 12 and 13-year-old children have been hospitalized in the past year after drinking until they blacked out. The network says while the system was able to provide crisis response, there are few preventative measures and major changes have yet to be made to funding and programs. Community groups are calling for what they call a place-based strategy to provide more flexible mental health and family support. Earlier this month, the province's representative for children and youth, Mary Ellen Turple-Lafon, said a review of case files on 15 suicides and 74 attempted suicides by young people over 3 years revealed gaping holes in the mental health care system that can often worsen problems rather than fix them.
And those were your campus and those were your campus and local headlines on News 101. It is now time for your weekend weather forecast brought to you by the UBC Storm Club. So current conditions, there's a large low system upon us, but visibly entering into occlusion. Before noon today, we had just over 20 millimeters of rain, and our models say that this would be the system has to offer. Expect cloudy skies and a light breeze tomorrow and Sunday, but trace to no precipitation. Temperatures around 6 degrees. And the official forecast brought to you with Environment Canada for today, rained ending this afternoon, then cloudy, windy with a high 10. For tonight, mainly cloudy, 60% chance of showers before morning, low 5. Saturday, mainly cloudy, 60% chance of showers in the morning, high 9. For Sunday, cloudy, low plus 4, high 7. From the UBC Storm Club, have a great weekend. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM. We're just going to take a quick break, but do stay with us for your national news. Check this out, y'all.
Listen up, fellow students, readers, and patrons of the UBC Bookstore. This upcoming November 27th, our beloved bookstore is hosting their very own Res Night for all UBC students. They'll be treating you to a night of free snacks to keep that brain fed, gaming, music courtesy of DJ Ochre, and need I mention, crazy discounts on books and supplies. Watch me be there stacking up on pencil cases. We're kicking the night off at 5 p.m., and for more info, check out the website at bookstore.ubc.ca.
And welcome back to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca. You can, of course, listen to our latest interviews and our podcast on our website, citr.ca/news. It is now time for our Simply Science segment brought to you by Sarah Chow. This week, she interviews Dr. Shaw and Dr. Tom Lenovic about an HPV vaccine.
This is Simply Science, bringing you your science news. I'm Sarah Chow. To vaccinate or not to vaccinate? That seems to be the big question lately. But when it comes to the human papillomavirus, or HPV vaccine, UBC's very own neuroscientist, Dr. Shaw and Dr. Tomljenovec, may help clear things up. According to Merck Frost, one of the biggest pharmaceutical giants in Canada, Gardasil is the only HPV vaccine on the market. It's targeted towards both males and females between the ages 15 to 24, and claims to protect against 75% of cervical and vaginal cancer cases in young women and 90% of genital wart cases in men. Side effects include pain, swelling, and according to Merck, worst case scenario, faint and hurt yourself. Doesn't seem too bad, does it? I had a chance to visit Dr. Shaw and Dr. Tomljenovec at their lab in VGH, who are on a mission to show that Gardasil is not as safe as we think. So why don't we just start with your recently published paper and that's got headlines in the news. Why don't you explain it?
These were two young women. One was 14, one was 19, I believe. Separated geographically, one from Montreal, one from New Zealand, who had died, their parents believed, as a consequence of the HPV Gardasil vaccine. And in both cases, coroner reports were prepared. They found no obvious things that could have explained the deaths. So in both cases, the parents ultimately came to us because they know of our work in vaccine safety, mm-hmm. and they came to us seeking answers. And what we told both sets of parents is that we could do some basic histology on brain samples. Nothing we did would be conclusive because we didn't have controls. It would only be a case study. But we could at least get some insight into maybe something that had happened and use that as the basis for more extensive studies. And what we saw in both cases, what looked to be vasculitis, leakage of the blood vessels in the brain, and that these proteins were adhering to vessel walls and also in the choroid plexus, which is an area that serves as sort of a manufacturing of a cerebrospinal fluid and other things like that.
There were two major findings. Basically, the HPV-16 antibodies seem to recognize certain type of cells in the brain within the lumen of the blood vessels mm-hmm. and also attaching to the walls of the blood vessels. What we know from experiments in animal models, and this has been demonstrated beyond any shadow of the doubt, that once you inject aluminum nanoparticles, and well, aluminum, because aluminum is adjuvant, which is added to many vaccines, including Gardasil, the macrophages take up the particles of aluminum, and they transport it to lymph nodes. Mm-hmm. And from the lymph nodes, a proportion of these particles ends up in the brain, and it triggers inflammatory reactions in the brain. What you hear from most medical authorities is that aluminum is excreted rapidly, and so it doesn't pose a hazard. But the experimentation both in humans and animals showed that that's not true.
For injectable aluminum. That's the crucial difference. The route of administration is absolutely crucial. If you eat it, if you have normal kidney function, you excrete most of it. Mm-hmm. But adjuvants are not meant to be excreted. They're meant to stick around and present the antigen over and over and over and over and over again. That's how they work. They hyperdrive the immune system.
So aluminum is basically like a vessel for the antigen.
The antigen actually binds to it. What it does is it gets hauled around by macrophages.
Okay.
So it actually now has that ability to migrate from the site of injection to other places. And it's not being excreted. It seems to stick around for an awfully long time. In fact, they don't seem to see it coming out at all. What you'll hear from the various health authorities is, a cup of coffee has more aluminum than a shot. And that's true. You're going to pee that away in the next hour, whereas you're not going to pee away your adjuvant aluminum. It's too big. Aluminum, we should also mention, is an extremely toxic metal in terms of biological system. Aluminum is not supposed to be in any biological system at all. Nothing.
Right.
There is nothing that uses aluminum for any important biological reaction. And aluminum toxicity may be very much dependent on very susceptibility genetic factors that we don't understand.
The really disturbing point is that you hear from medical authorities that it's extremely safe. Hundreds and hundreds of studies have shown that aluminum is safe from vaccinations, and that it's been in use for 70 years and the research has not demonstrated any problem. But then I always say to people, please, before you decide, please read the methods of the paper.
Yeah.
And a lot of these studies that allegedly shows that the aluminum is safe are quite flawed in their methodology. So vaccines are primarily designed to prevent diseases, and some of these diseases, there's a very low chance of exposure. there's a low risk for adverse effects for something that's meant to prevent disease. Because if someone's a cancer patient and they've been given, you know, a year to live, they'll take a risk if the treatment is toxic because they have nothing to lose, right?
So they'll try anything, and rightly so, I would too. Okay. Mm-hmm. But that's different. These are sick people who are going to get worse. Vaccines are given to healthy people to prevent them from getting sick, so the threshold for adverse reactions has to be much lower than it would be for an experimental drug.
Okay, so let's go back to your paper, and you talked about the methods section, and so in your methods, now this paper is a little bit different because it has two case studies, and there's no control, and that's very different from other papers. What is the difference between those two?
Well, it's different from other papers we've published. This is the first time we've done a case study. Because normally we would have controls, we would have done a power analysis, they would be adequately powered. We did this because these were very striking examples of something that seemed to be a pathological condition, and we wanted to basically alert our medical colleagues to the possibility that something was going on, and to generate more research in this area. You know, we were applying for permit through CREB to actually conduct a larger controlled study all on postmortem tissue to actually see if there's actually something to this. And so, again, this is not the way we'd normally design a study, but this is, again, within that broad spectrum of research that's done in a medical faculty. It is an accepted kind of research, with the caveats that it is preliminary. It's the first step in what will probably be a very long research project to actually demonstrate, in fact, that there is anything to the idea that there's something toxic happening in the brains of these people, and to actually establish causality, if there is causality to be established.
So this is kind of like the start of something bigger.
Absolutely. We hope to spur other researchers elsewhere to try and duplicate or refute our findings. If we're wrong, then we're wrong, and then we can eliminate that as a possible cause of death for these unfortunate children. And if we're right, then it needs to be examined more thoroughly and then taken more seriously by the medical establishment.
So is it possible that these two case studies are just a coincidence?
Could be. It absolutely could be. I mean, again, you know, for all we know, vasculitis in 14-year-old girls is normal. Or it could be that we just, out of two random, you know, samples of adverse reactions that might not have even been the Gardasil, that people died from other reasons, and we just got the two outliers. Of course it's true. And we don't know. Proving causality is always going to be difficult. It may always be correlational in many senses, just because, again, you can't prove that when someone dies, especially when there's a temporal lag, in both of these women there was, you can't prove that the vaccine did it. But think back to how long it took to prove causality for smoking and cancer. It took 30 years. It took a huge body of information, because when you smoke a cigarette, you don't drop dead the next day, as a general rule. But the body of evidence and longitudinal studies of smokers demonstrated conclusively after a long time that this was true. Even the study that we're proposing will go a long way towards establishing some sort of strong correlation. Whether we can ever prove causality, I don't know. There's some discussion about that. It's hard to do that with anything of this nature. When you're not in an experimental model, you're dealing with a human population, especially postmortem.
Make sure you tune in for the second part of this interview in the next edition of Simply Science. Well, that's it for this week for Simply Science. For CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, British Columbia, I'm Sarah Chow.
And thank you to Sarah Chow for bringing us that Simply Science segment. You can, of course, listen to that on our website, citr.ca/news. And make sure to tune in on Monday to hear part two. We are now going to take a quick break, but do stay with us for our international headlines.
Are your hands lightning fast? Can you flip it, scratch it, and just get downright funky on the turntables? Well, if so, you got to come out and prove it, homeboy. On November 23rd, CITR presents Are You That DJ competition going down Friday night at the Pit Pub. $8 to get you in the door on the day, but only $5 if you get your pass in advance. It's time to set the record straight on who's got the ill skills on the wheels of steel. So ante up and save the date, November 23rd at the Pit Pub. For more info on how you can get involved, hit up Campus Coordinator via email at campuscoordinator@citr.ca. Brought to you by CITR.
Who is the number one DJ?
And welcome back to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca. It is now time for your international headlines, and for that we go to Free Speech Radio News.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN.
We want patriotism free!
Education must be free!
Thousands of students marched through the streets of London today, protesting education cuts, rising fees, and lower economic prospects for graduates in the UK. Video from The Guardian shows chanting students marching in cold, wet weather while holding signs. The protests, organized by the National Union of Students, comes 2 years after a similar protest then attracted large crowds and turned violent in some areas. Fighting continued today in Syria. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights reports clashes in several parts of the country, including air raids dropping, quote, explosive barrels on at least one village. Turkey is requesting military assistance from NATO in the form of missile defense against cross-border Syrian fighting spillover. NATO Secretary Anders Fogh Rasmussen said the military alliance would consider the request.
Such a deployment would augment Turkey's air defense to defend the population and territory of Turkey. It would contribute to the de-escalation of the crisis along NATO's southeastern border.
Rasmussen said it's up to Germany, the Netherlands, and the U.S., the countries with Patriot missiles, to decide if they will provide the weapons to Turkey. Today, authorities in India executed the lone surviving gunman in the 2008 attack that killed more than 160 people in Mumbai. FSRN's Bismillah Gilani reports.
The execution of Ajmal Amir Kasab was carried out early Wednesday morning in a highly secretive manner. As soon as the news of the hanging spread, celebrations broke out in several Indian cities. Victims of the Mumbai attack and most political parties supported the execution. The government says the death penalty was carried out after a fair trial and due process of law. Foreign Minister Salman Khurshid says the sentence is a warning to terrorists.
And I hope that this message is conveyed not only to the rest of the world but to those who have toyed with the idea of trifling with India's security, that they would now think many times over before they do such adventurism again.
Human rights groups, however, have condemned the hanging, with Amnesty International calling it a significant step backward. Just a day before today's execution, India voted against a UN resolution seeking abolition of death penalty. The United States, Japan, and China are among 38 countries who opposed the resolution at the United Nations. Bismillah Gilani, Free Speech Radio News, New Delhi.
The M23 rebel group in the Democratic Republic of Congo says it plans to continue its march and overtake the capital, Kinshasa. Yesterday, the rebels took a major city in the eastern part of the country. It's widely believed the rebels have deep connections to Rwanda. The U.S. is calling the actions of the rebels an affront to the sovereignty of the DRC and is urging regional leaders to take steps to stop the group's advance. But as the international community focuses on M23 rebels, other militias in the country have been able to operate with impunity. The UN Human Rights Office says 264 people, including more than 80 children, were executed by armed militias in the eastern DRC between April and September. Cecile Pouilly is a spokesperson for the UN Human Rights Office.
Many victims were hacked to death with machetes, and others were burned alive. And there were also a massive force displacement and large-scale lootings and destruction of private property.
At least 12 women were raped. The U.S. and Mexico have signed a treaty governing the use of water on the Colorado River. FSRN's Shannon Young reports.
The five-year deal signed yesterday and described as historic will allow the U.S. to buy some of Mexico's share of river water. Part of the water will be for residential use in the U.S. Southwest, and the rest to ensure the Colorado flows all the way to the Gulf of California. The existing binational treaty allotted the entirety of the river's water for regional use, leaving nothing behind for the ecosystem. The Colorado River currently dries up short of its delta, a former marshland. The deal is the result of 3 years of talks. If successful, the five-year program will lay the groundwork for a longer-term river management deal in 2019. While the water designated in the agreement to restore freshwater flows represents only a tiny fraction of the Colorado River's volume, scientists involved in the project are optimistic that it will be enough to at least begin restoration of the Delta's ecosystem. Shannon Young, FSRN, Mexico.
And that's headlines for FSRN. From Black Mountain, North Carolina, I'm Jess
With
Burns.
A ceasefire in place, rockets from Gaza and airstrikes from Israel are expected to pause at least temporarily. But the long-term effects of bombings and airstrikes for the residents of Gaza may linger. Two scientific studies released earlier this year found a strong correlation between Israel's use of military weapons in the area and birth defects in Gaza children. Researchers at the University of Genoa in Italy and medical staff in Gaza saw kidney, cardiac, lung, gastrointestinal, and other defects in the children of Palestinians exposed to white phosphorus, uranium, and other toxic substances. For more, we're joined by Fabio De Ponte, spokesperson for the New Weapons Committee. That's the group that released the research. He joins us from Turin, Italy. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you.
Your research took place at the Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza, looking at birth defects and the parents' exposure to toxic chemicals. What did the reports find?
Well, in May, we published a scientific study entitled Birth Defects in Gaza, Prevalence Types, Familiarity and Correlation with Environmental Factors. And it's a long name, and in essence, the meaning is that we tried to find a correlation between birth defects, newborns, and the parents' exposure to attacks with the white phosphorus. And the result was that we found a strong correlation between these two elements. And the result was that at the registration at birth, the 27% of parents with birth defects children declared exposure to white phosphorus, while only 1.7% of parents with normal children made the same declaration.
So some 27% of parents recording birth defects of their children, as you note the results there. How were the parents exposed to this white phosphorus?
Basically, by exposure, we mean to live in urban areas where the white phosphorus was used. So actually to live in a house in the neighborhood where this stuff was used.
So the findings from this research have to do with the use of white phosphorus in 2009. It's 3 years after that. White phosphorus has not been confirmed to be used in this current assault on Gaza by Israel. Are there other toxic substances from bombings that could present dangers?
Yes, actually, the bombings leave in the land some toxic metals like uranium, tungsten, and mercury, cadmium, cobalt, and other toxic metals of this kind.
Well, a ceasefire has been announced today, but there are hundreds of attacks on Gaza since the assault began last week. These metals that you're listing, how long do they last in the environment?
That's the most difficult question to answer, because we do not know how long the effect will last on the land, on the environment, and also on the human beings. So that's why this group of of scientists is carrying out these studies to explore this stuff. We really do not know how long these effects will remain in the land and affect the environment. We really do not know this.
Fabio De Ponte is spokesperson for the New Weapons Committee. The organization has released research on the toxic effects of airstrikes on Gaza. Fabio De Ponte, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you, everything.
In eastern Texas today, protesters blocked construction of the southern leg of the Trans-Canada Keystone XL pipeline. When finished, the pipeline would transport crude oil from the tar sands of Canada to the Gulf of Mexico. Activists climbed trees in the path of the pipeline and chained themselves to machinery, bringing construction of the pipeline to a halt. Police arrested at least five people and used pepper spray on protesters who refused to leave the site. We spoke with FSRN reporter Andrew Oxford earlier today. He was at the site near Wells, Texas, as police began to move in. Andrew, describe the scene where you are now.
Well, I'm standing on what is a pretty narrow and otherwise unremarkable country road near Wells, Texas today. And there's about 150-foot wide strip of clear-cut land running through the forest. This is where TransCanada is hoping to lay the Keystone XL pipeline, but in their way today are four activists who are locked onto heavy machinery that was being used to clear-cut some of this pine forest. The construction was stopped earlier this morning when somewhere between 30 and 40 activists marched onto the site, disrupted construction, and these activists chained themselves down to machinery. Not far from here, there's another action. Several activists have ascended trees in the path of the pipeline and have set up what they hope will be a tree sit similar to the one in Winnsboro, Texas, which is currently in its 56th day. The police there are also on the scene and are said to be working to bring them down today.
Andrew, at the site where you are now, you describe four protesters who chained themselves to machinery. What has the police response been?
Well, there are sheriff's deputies, constables, and local police officers on the scene right now, as well as private security contractors. And they appear to be focusing on the two activists who have chained themselves underneath a large earth mover. Sheriff's deputies just appeared to have sprayed one of the demonstrators with pepper spray, and he appears to be in quite a bit of physical pain at the moment. He just doused his face with water. But otherwise, they do appear to be quite stuck, literally, underneath these earth movers, bringing construction here to a halt for the day. Law enforcement is deliberating, but there's no telling how long this could go on.
We're speaking with Andrew Oxford, reporter who is in eastern Texas at the site where protesters have blocked construction in the Keystone XL pipeline there. Andrew, have you had a chance to speak with anybody there on the ground?
Yeah, I have. I've been speaking to a few activists, and they're all optimistic about the prospects of setting up new tree sits, about the possibilities of direct action, doing what it's done today, which is stopping construction on the southern portion of the Keystone XL pipeline. But I also heard a lot of activists talking about their hopes that this campaign can broaden. Construction crews here are moving very quickly, faster than perhaps activists can keep up. And the hope is that the effort to stop the Keystone XL pipeline will broaden into solidarity actions across the country, will really target the oil companies involved in constructing this pipeline, not just TransCanada, but companies like Valero and Chevron, which have major stakes in the completion of this pipeline.
And why this particular site? Why is this area significant? Why have protesters chosen to make a stand here?
Well, East Texas, these small towns from Nacogdoches, from Wells, all the way up to Winnsboro, towns that I'm sure are not often heard of beyond Texas, have really found themselves at the center of the efforts to build the Keystone XL pipeline. Because even though the application for the entire pipeline was initially rejected, the company TransCanada is going ahead with building the pipeline from Cushing, Oklahoma to Port Arthur, Texas, the southern portion of that pipeline. Crews have been working very fast to procure land, right-of-way through controversial eminent domain practices. And meanwhile, environmentalists have been working to mobilize in these communities to work with landowners who are not pleased with the way that TransCanada has been using eminent domain to get right-of-way. as well as with local environmentalists, to carry out actions like today that can actually stop construction here in these communities where the pipeline is set to run straight through.
That's FSRN's Andrew Oxford near Wells, Texas, where protesters have halted construction of the Keystone XL pipeline. Some have been arrested. Andrew, thank you for the report.
Well, thank you.
Hi, folks. This is DJ Abe. Tune into my show, Toss Got Some Donuts, every Monday from 6:30 a.m. to 8 a.m. on CITR 101.9 FM. So let's get grooving, dancing, and smiling in the morning.
And thank you to Free Speech Radio News for bringing us those international headlines. Daily headlines and their full newscast can be found on their website, fsrn.org. You are listening to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca. And that does it. And we have Matt here up next, who is going to be giving us a little bit of Australian-Canadian spice on CITR. And that is our program new here on News 101 for today, Friday, November 23rd, 2012. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved, or give us an important news tip, please contact us through our email, news@citr.ca. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to our latest interviews and segments on our website, citr.ca/news. And for more independent news, please join us on Monday and Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Chirag Mahajan. And my co-host was Claire Eagle, who's off to watch a hockey game. Today's show was produced by the both of us from the entire news team at CITR. Thank you for listening. Stay tuned for Stranded with your host Matt right here on CITR 101.9 FM.